From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. For Catholics, the selection of a new pope has made March a month of celebration, but it's also a time of sacrifice. It is Lent. And in Louisiana, some businesses have something to celebrate. A little free marketing, thanks to the Catholic hierarchy, as Tina Antolini reports.
This whole story starts with a letter written 3 years ago by a guy named Jim Pikulis. He was trying to settle a debate among his friends. Is it okay to eat alligator during Lent?
Most of my friends here in Louisiana are Catholic, and they were saying no, that it was not, and some were saying yes, that it was. And it was, well, let me take this to the Archbishop, because then he's going to set the record straight.
For the uninitiated, Catholics abstain from eating meat on Fridays during the time between Ash Wednesday and Easter. Seafood, however, is allowed, and Pikulis wanted to know if gator qualified. He's not just casually interested, though.
Now, people, we have about 2,000 alligators here at the ranch.
He's an alligator wrangler at Instigator Ranch and Hatchery in Covington, Louisiana. He leads daily tours and shows folks the chirping babies.
Did you have a question, my brother? What was that?
It's a good thing you trained these alligators. Ooh. Otherwise, we'd all be like Thanksgiving to them.
Pikulis is an extreme alligator enthusiast, spouting facts about their dental prowess and giving the babies nicknames like Lady Gaga. And his letter must have been pretty zealous, because not long after he wrote it...
From the Archdiocese, dear Jim...
That's me.
Pikulis got a response.
Yes, the alligator is considered in the fish family, and I agree with you. God has created a magnificent creature that is important to the state of Louisiana, and it is considered seafood. Wishing you God's blessing, I am, sincerely in Christ, Most Reverend Gregory M. Amond, Archbishop of New Orleans.
Now, ever since Amond wrote that letter in 2010, it's been on the wall in the gift shop at Instigator Ranch. This year, Pikulis posted it on Facebook. It went from being shared hundreds of times to making the news. Articles on eating gator for Lent popped up everywhere, from CatholicFoodie.com to the Catholic News Agency. But has all of this meant New Orleanians are switching to gator on Fridays? Jay Nix would be in a position to know.
Alligator is such a natural for New Orleans. Alligator, gumbo, jambalaya. I mean, it's a wonder that alligator isn't our mascot, you know.
Nix owns Parkway Bakery, which serves a mean alligator sausage poor boy sandwich. He says in a culturally Catholic city like New Orleans, where even the unreligious eat fish on Lenten Fridays, he gets slammed with seafood orders. And a bump in gator might balance things out.
Well, you would think that it would take some pressure off of our shrimp sales, because we could go through 300-400 pounds of shrimp a day. And so when Lent comes, it sort of gives us a little bit of the jitters.
Some extra gator marketing this Lenten season has been a welcome thing at Parkway and other restaurants in the city that serve it, from fried alligator at Cochon to the alligator cheesecake at Giacomo's. But with all the gator fever, Archbishop Amond has a reminder. Speaking recently on member station WWNO, he says Lent is about deprivation. Remember?
Abstinence and fasting is supposed to be a sacrifice.
But Amond himself was born in New Orleans, and in a city this rich in seafood.
Quite frankly, and I can say this because I'm from New Orleans, having to fulfill this law or this guideline of abstinence of meat on Friday is no sacrifice whatsoever. That's the reality of it.
In New Orleans, it might take going vegetarian for Catholics to really feel deprived. For NPR News, I'm Tina Antolini.
If you'd like to find a good recipe for alligator, head to our website. You can hear James Beard Award-winning chef Stephen Strajewski from New Orleans describe how he cooks fried alligator with chili garlic aioli. That's at NPR.org.
If you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne. If you've ever had a glass of California Chardonnay that was not from a box, you can give a toast of thanks to Jim Barrett. The 86-year-old vintner passed away last week after an interesting and varied life, leaving a lasting legacy in American wine production.
You know, the guy went from being an attorney to a lieutenant on a submarine in the Korean War to owning one of the best American wineries. I mean, it's a pretty amazing life.
That's Scott Wilson. He's one of the Three Wine Guys, a podcasting trio of wine aficionados. He says that when Barrett showed up in Napa Valley in the 1970s, the place was hardly the lush green countryside we see today.
It definitely was a different world than it was now. I mean, you drive down Napa and it's winery after winery. It was actually real farm country, and the Chateau Montelena had been in disarray for decades.
Barrett bought the chateau and set about transforming it. He spoke about those early days with some of his pioneering comrades in a 2011 panel for the Napa Valley Vintners, a winemaker's trade association.
I was a lawyer for 28 years, putting frowns on people's faces. Now I put smiles. See? And that's how I got into the wine business. Came up here to the valley, looked at it, and I've been a city boy all my life. And I said, damn, this is fantastic. Things grow out here. It isn't concrete, you know, and it's not high buildings.
Barrett had a lot of work ahead of him, not just to revitalize Chateau Montelena, but to defy the stereotype of domestic wines as mass-produced swill, says the other wine guy podcaster we spoke with, Steve-O Anthony.
In the 60s, there was a real bad connotation for wines in general. We didn't think of wines as from California or Napa or Sonoma as having any cachet whatsoever.
Serious wine dealers completely ignored American products. But Barrett changed all that when his Chateau Montelena Chardonnay put America on the wine map in a dramatic way. This is the big wine competition.
Yes, this is the judgment in Paris in May 26, 1976.
A British wine merchant organized a blind taste test, putting some of the up-and-coming American wines against French wines.
He thought it would be kind of fun in our bicentennial year.
1976.
To kind of, 1976, yeah, to basically kind of put egg on our face. And lo and behold, we shocked the world.
And this was up against some of the big names in French wine. First growths like Chateau Mouton Rothschild, Chateau Haute-Brionne.
Romanée Conti from Burgundy. I mean, the best of Bordeaux, the best of Burgundy were there to make us look bad.
But rather than look bad, Barrett's American wine took first place among the white wines.
And it was a huge controversy. One of the judges grabbed her ballot and wanted to tear it up. And they based the movie Bottle Shock off it.
La première place. Au Chateau Montelena, the Napa Valley, California.
I mean, it was a situation where not only did the little guy end up beating up the bully, but then he ended up, you know, dating his sister as well. It was awesome.
How important was it that that Jim Barrett come along? You know, how different might things be if he had just stayed in his Chicago law firm all those years ago instead of heading out to California?
We might be drinking French wine.
Exactly. Or Italian.
Or Australian, yeah.
Yes.
Or gin and tonics.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, we raise a glass for him today.
Cheers.
Scott Wilson and Steve-O Anthony are two of the three Wine Guys podcasting trio. Thank you both for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, and have a good day.
Thank you so much.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish. Environmentalists and beekeepers are calling on the government to ban some of the most popular insect-killing chemicals in the country. The pesticides are used to coat the seed of many agricultural crops. They protect crops from insect pests. But as NPR's Dan Charles reports, they may also be killing bees.
During the winter, when Midwestern fields lie frozen and quiet, farmers and their suppliers have a chance to catch up on the latest agricultural technology. On this day, they've packed a conference center in Bloomington, Illinois. And what they're learning is a little disturbing. Christian Krupke, a specialist on insects from Purdue University, is telling them about a dark side of some products that they use.
All right, so the big players here, you know these names, Cruiser and Poncho.
Cruiser and Poncho are insecticides, two members of a family of insecticides called neonicotinoids, or neonics. They're applied to practically all the country's corn seed as a sticky coating before planting, also lots of other crops. When a seed sprouts and grows, the chemicals spread through the whole plant. So insects like aphids that try to eat the plant get poisoned. But Krupke tells the farmers their neonics might be killing more than aphids. He puts up a picture of a beehive surrounded by a carpet of dead honeybees. In Indiana and several other places, there have been isolated reports of bees dying like this with traces of neonics on them. But the mystery has been, how could something that you bury in the soil with the seed end up in bees?
How are we getting this connection?
Okay, so here's part of the answer, Krupke says. He puts up another slide, a picture of a huge planting machine. These machines use air pressure to move seeds from storage bin to soil. Also, a soft powder, talc or graphite, keeps everything flowing smoothly. The air, along with some of the powder, blows out through a vent. We tested that planter exhaust, Krupke tells the farmers, and we found amazing levels of neonic pesticides, 700,000 times more than what it takes to kill a honeybee. That toxic dust can land on nearby flowers. Maybe that's how it gets on bees and kills them, because these die-offs all happened during corn planting season.
All right, that's all I have for today. Thank you.
The farmers clap politely when the talk is over. There aren't many questions. Krupke says most farmers just listen, but a few feel like doing something.
I've given talks like this several times, and it's probably at least two or three people that will say, you know, I care enough about this problem that I am going to seek to not use these materials.
Some environmentalists are now saying this shouldn't be left up to farmers. The Environmental Protection Agency should step in.
EPA should immediately take these two neonicotinoid pesticides off the market.
Paul Towers is a spokesman for the Pesticide Action Network. The problem, he says, is not just those cases where a lot of bees died all at once, maybe because of toxic dust from corn planters. Neonics also show up in the pollen of corn, canola, or sunflowers that grow from treated seed. Bees feed on that pollen. The amount of pesticide they get is so small it won't kill the bees outright, but it may have other effects.
Disorientation, reduced ability to gather food, impaired memory and learning, and a lack of ability to communicate with other bees.
Towers says this low-level exposure to neonics from millions of acres of seed-treated crops may be weakening honeybee hives, killing them slowly. Last week, his group, along with others, sued the Environmental Protection Agency, trying to force the EPA to ban neonics. Bayer Crop Science, the biggest seller of these pesticides, insists that most studies show that neonics are quite safe. David Fisher, the company's director of ecotoxicology, says in the real world, you cannot see neonics causing widespread harm to bees.
In Canada, all of the canola is grown from neonicotinoid-treated seed, or virtually all of it. And the health of the bees in that area of Canada, the prairie provinces, is as good as anywhere else in Canada.
But Bayer Crop Science is reacting to reports of bee kills. It's working on a new planting system, replacing the powder in planters with a waxy substitute. The company says making that change cuts the amount of neonics released from corn planters by 50%. For the critics of neonics, though, cutting releases just in half is not good enough. Dan Charles, NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Visitors to Mount Vernon will soon be able to take a sip of history. A batch of George Washington's straight rye whiskey is being made in a reconstruction of his old distillery from his own recipe using the fermentation process from his day. The George Washington whiskey will cost you 95 bills featuring his face, even though the product, according to historians who've tasted it, is very bad rye whiskey. It's Morning Edition.